So in terms of practice, there's a lot of, I mean, practice is very simple in its kind of basic, what we do. You know, you meditate, you keep the precepts, you're mindful. Okay, great. And then from that kind of basic foundation, of looking what our mind does, looking at how our mind affects our actions, there's a whole kind of vast volume of subtle Buddhist detail that we can bring to bear that help us to kind of get through the complexity of our life and the day, basically. In our tradition, embedded in our kind of orientation toward practice are a number of ideas that Dogen expresses in his writings. And Dogen can be a little bit inaccessible, can be a little bit difficult to get into. So I wanted to look at a couple of chapters that contain those kind of foundational ideas in our particular orientation toward practice. And as we go along, I hope that I'll be able to show how that's important in terms of kind of dealing with our daily life, basically. Because it all hinges on that idea of how can we put this into practice? How can we actually make the teaching real? So, because Dogen is, well, because I think because life is quite subtle and multifaceted, and Dogen has a deep understanding of both practice and how to practice Soto Zen in daily life, he's giving us a fairly complex view of the world and of his notion of what practice is. To me, that is a great benefit, because in my life, I don't encounter life as a black and white kind of proposition. It's not a simple matter. There are many different facets of life and many different ways of dealing with other people and dealing with my own life and mind. And the subtlety of the writings of Dogen and other teachers, and the subtlety of approach of other teachers, I find to be quite helpful, because it helps me, again, to understand how to really negotiate the complexity of life. And again, it's all kind of rests on this simple foundation of meditation, the precepts, which anybody can apply. So Dogen is presenting a complex view of life and the practice. And because of his complex view, how what he says is translated can affect how we understand what he says. You probably have some awareness of that, encountering translation in other aspects of life. And it happens that with Dogen, it seems to become even more apparent. Well, maybe it's because it's my area of interest or expertise that I am aware of. I think there's maybe five different translations of the Shokugenzo out on the market today. And each one of them has a slightly different facet of what Dogen's trying to say. So part of what I want to talk about is some issues about those translations, and also how we can read Dogen so that we can make use of what he's saying. A lot of times when I read Dogen, I think to myself, my God, you know, I have no idea what this man is talking about. It's just way over my head. And even after many years of study, that's still the case. I still kind of read Dogen and think, you know, what was that all about? And there are ideas that I can approach, and there are aspects of chapters that I can approach. And over time, in rereading chapters of Dogen, I can see that my understanding of what he's saying has shifted and changed, hopefully deepened. So I want to talk about a little bit about how I go about reading Dogen, how I was taught to go about reading Dogen, and how I've kind of adapted that to my own kind of life and practice. The chapter that I want to talk about, so 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 I think our idea was that I'm going to talk about a chapter called Genjoku on it for the next 3 Sundays, so you'll be kind of stuck struggling with Dogen with me for the next 3 Sundays. And it's possible we may do the same thing in the, after we get back from the Abbey with a chapter called Gakudo Yojinshu. And again, I think these are 2 chapters which Burgmaster Jita thought was important enough to translate and put into her book, you know, Zen's Eternal Life, because they really have some kind of fundamental ideas about practice and how we can orient ourselves through practice. And also how we can understand the behavior and the structure of the temple and the people in the temple and what we're talking and what our kind of basic orientation is toward practice. So these are kind of pretty important things to cover. So my apologies if you find it difficult. So first, when I'm reading Dogen, I am thinking of it as if it were, in a sense, scripture, in the sense of like the morning service scriptures, which we recite and don't necessarily stop to think about while we're reciting them. After a while, you probably notice this yourself. You come and you go through morning service, and you don't actually, you just kind of recite the scripture of great wisdom. You don't actually think about it all that much. You, in a sense, just allow it to wash over your mind. There are times when we sit down and think about the scripture of great wisdom, and that's good. It's important to understand, at least on a basic conceptual level, what's being talked about. But most of the time, when we're reciting our daily scriptures, we just allow them to kind of go in one ear and out the other. And while that description, you know, you're usually not encouraged to allow things to go in one ear and out the other, you are actually here. Because in the process, it is doing something. It's responding to something. It's addressing some issue on a level of our minds that we're not necessarily aware of. In a way, reciting the daily scriptures is a bit like watering a plant. You don't necessarily see what the water is doing down there with the roots. But if you don't water the plant, then the plant will wither and die. And reciting scriptures on a periodic basis has that same effect. It's going in there. You know, one of the fundamental ideas of our tradition is that all beings at heart are Buddhas. And we may not kind of see that, but because that is the orientation of our practice, that's what the people like Dogen, the great masters of our tradition, have seen to be true. We can have faith in that, and we can recognize it in a sense. Oh, that has a kind of ring to it, that has a truth to it. And by, say, reciting the scriptures, we're, in a sense, adding water to that fundamental Buddha heart of ours. We're nourishing it by kind of reciting things which resonate with that kind of true part of ourselves. And someone like Dogen is also trying to talk to that part of us. He's trying to talk to that deep part of us which partakes of Buddha nature, which is Buddha nature. We talk about Dogen and his great work, which is called the Shobogenzo, the Eye and Treasury of the True Heart. That is one translation of that word, Shobogenzo. And that kind of masterwork of Dogen's is like 110 chapters of, or some odd, of basically what amounts to Dharma talks given to his community of monks and lay people. And during those Dharma talks, what he's trying to do is help people by talking to Buddha nature, by talking to the deepest part of their mind. And a lot of times in my experience, sitting through many Dharma talks in that vein, in the meditation hall, you may not know what the person is actually talking about. You may not have any kind of conceptual idea what they're talking about. And yet, the process of sitting still in meditation and listening to a Dharma talk, there's something that it addresses, and there's some change that happens in each of us when we go through that process. So by reading Dogen, even if we don't necessarily, again, conceptually understand what's going on or what he's talking about, it is getting in there. It is getting in there and addressing something. And that may not bear fruit for some time, but eventually you have the experience of thinking, oh, that's what they were talking about. And the process of continually coming back to trying to engage in it helps to foster that fruition process. So again, just the fact of coming day in, day out, week in and week out to the temple, going through morning service, again, is adding water and is helping with the fruition process of coming to understand what is being taught. So when I read Dogen, I do it with that same attempt in my mind that I would go into a Dharma talk, which is to that you would listen to formally in meditation, in a Dharma talk, formal meditational Dharma talk. We would just sit still in our places in the meditation hall as if we were doing meditation, and just listen to what the teacher giving the talk has to say. We just sit still and really just meditate and listen, and not necessarily try to engage it with our minds. Just allow it to wash over. I was talking, I'm in contact with a few people around, and I was having an email exchange with a woman in California, and she was saying she wanted me to suggest some things that she could recite as a sangha kind of ceremony, and so I was talking about Dogen and referring her to some chapters of Dogen, and she said, oh yeah, it's only been recently that I've been able to actually read Dogen, because I was constantly trying to figure him out. And it's only someone suggested that I just let it wash over me, and finally the penny dropped, and I realized, oh, I can just do that, and I don't have to figure it out, and I don't have to struggle against it. Because there's a part of our mind that wants it to be all clear and nice, and it isn't. And in a sense, it is deliberately not clear and nice. In a sense, Dogen is trying to confound our capacity of our mind to try to make it all nice and orderly. He's putting up an idea here and talk about that, and you'll think, oh yeah, that's nice. And then he'll say virtually the opposite thing and contradict what he just said before. And then you kind of go, what? And then he'll say a third thing, which in a sense contradicts that. And so he's kind of constantly going around. Master Jiu said, we need to develop what she called a kaleidoscopic mind. That the truth and life and the Dharma are like facets in a kaleidoscope, which are constantly moving. You're looking at the same thing, but you see them from different perspectives and with different qualities of life and all of that. So in our minds, we can cultivate that kind of quality of mind which doesn't necessarily insist on things being a certain way. It doesn't insist on things according to a certain understanding, while at the same time still having faith that there is a coherence to it. So again, as I'm reading Dogen, I'm just trying to sit still, just go through it with my just read through it. Sometimes I'll actually read it out loud. I remember having a meal with one of the I was sharing a house with some lay people in Portland, and my housemate's son was over. He was like 10 or something like that, and I was sharing a meal with him, and I said the five thoughts to myself, but I said it with my lips, and he kind of laughed at me and said, oh, can't you just say that in your mind? And I was kind of embarrassed, being 20 or something like that. But then I realized, oh wait, there is actually something to saying it out loud. Not in the sense of, like I can remember what the five thoughts are and say it to myself, but by actually kind of putting voice to it, it changes, it enables me to just say it in a way that allows it to wash over me. So sometimes if I'm particularly engaged in the mind that wants to figure it out. I'll actually read Dogen out loud to myself. And in that sense, it becomes more like a recitation. It takes a while to, it takes a bit of kind of experimenting with yourself to really try to find out how to do that, how to read without engaging in trying to figure it out. Part of it is just reading through it and not necessarily always kind of, once you read through it and you realize, I don't understand that, not necessarily going back to try to figure it out. Because one of the things that happens with Dogen is that he will say something which you don't necessarily understand, and then a little bit later he will explain that thing, or something he will say will have it make sense. So if you can just, it's like, in a sense, reading a poem. You can just read through it and allow it to have its effect and see whether anything comes of that. Maybe nothing will. Maybe something will stand out. Maybe there will just be one sentence that speaks to you and says, oh, that is interesting. That changes my perspective on something. Okay. So in terms of reading Dogen, it just requires a little bit of patience and that willingness to not try to figure things out and allow things to walk out. There, now in terms of translation, Dogen is speaking, he was actually quite an innovator, literary innovator. He was one of the first people, my understanding is he was one of the first people to actually write and speak in idiomatic Japanese. So he's very scholarly. He was trained from an early age to be a monastic in the Tendai tradition, which is very, very scholarly, has a deep reputation for studying the scriptures. He was said to have read the Tripitaka, the complete Tripitaka, which is the kind of Buddhist canon, by the time he was 15 or something like that, which is, you know, quite a feat. I hadn't even approached that myself. Of course, most of it's still in Chinese, so it's pretty simple. He came from a background where he was kind of well-to-do. His family's very well-educated. He's very, very deeply trained in classical Chinese poetry and Chinese literary tradition. He loves poetry. He, in fact, kind of criticizes himself for, he's kind of saying, oh, gee, I kind of like poetry at one point. And maybe I shouldn't write poetry, but I do. And write some beautiful Japanese poetry. So anyway, he's an innovator. He writes in a Chinese classical form, but writes in idiomatic Japanese. And this was quite new for his time. The recent vogue has been to think of Dogen as being a kind of genius of his time, not necessarily a religious genius, but just a genius of his time. And so scholars approach him from that point of view, and they talk about, you know, kind of philosophical ideas that come out of Dogen and his literary innovation and all this stuff, which, you know, is fair enough, it's fine. I'm sure it's actually there. In terms of practice, however, all of that, you know, may or may not actually have that much significance. It might be interesting individually. And also, in terms of practice, it tends to, again, cultivate that mind which wants to figure it out and wants to provide a kind of complex description of what is going on with Dogen. And in a sense, that wasn't really what Dogen set out to do. He didn't set out to develop a philosophical system. He didn't set out to do literary innovation. He was like Shakespeare, developed a number of words, for instance, that in order to express his point. He didn't set out to do that. What he was trying to do was communicate his religious understanding to the people who were studying with him. And so, in terms of practice, from our point of view, that, in a way, is how, you know, kind of my interest in Dogen. That's what my orientation toward Dogen is. is to understand what he's trying to tell me spiritually. And that's my approach, and that's how I talk about him, and that's how I have come to understand him. Again, in terms of translations, you can read different translations of Dogen, and they all have different characters. There's one that we don't have here, which is the Nishijima Cross translation. Translated by two people whose last names are Nishijima and Cross. And their approaches to try to one of the things that they find important is to capture the sound of the Japanese language, how it actually sounds when it's spoken. And so it has a particular quality to it, which is interesting and has its own kind of value, I think. And by doing that, it doesn't necessarily address, in a way, what Dogen is talking about to us spiritually, because it emphasizes that kind of sound of the Japanese language. So it doesn't necessarily put things into straightforward English. And of course, being a translator is really quite a difficult job, because you basically have to understand the idiomatic nuance of the language that you're translating from, but you also have to understand the idiomatic nuance of the language that you're translating into. So you have to be sort of experts, not only in language, but the literal meaning of language, but how that language works within the culture that it's being kind of presented in. So it's a tricky deal. One of the things that we're then emphasizing, and a lot of monks in our tradition will emphasize, is looking at a translation from this perspective of practice. And one of the reasons that Reverend Master Jiu asked Reverend Master Hubert to translate the Shomgenzo was so that it could be done from the point of view of a monastic or someone who is engaged full-time in practice. There's nothing special about being a monastic, just they happen to be engaged full-time in practice. And so this translation, which is available on the web by Reverend Master Hubert, is done from, as best he could, that perspective. He also happens to have been a Japanese scholar in his former life. He was an expert in no drama and Japanese theater. And that, in a way, gave him ancient Japanese theater. So that, in a way, gave him that expertise. He had the expertise in language, plus a wide experience in how language is presented, how it's idiomatically presented in a cultural context. And, of course, he's pretty good about speaking English as well. So that's one of the virtues of this translation. Interestingly, I kind of grew up studying Reverend Master Jiu's translation in Zen's Eternal Life. And the translation in this collection, the Nishiyama Stevens translation of the Genzo. And so when I think about Dogen, a lot of the little kind of quotes and ideas are articulated in this form, which, if you listen to Reverend Master Jiu's lectures on the Shogenzo, she was kind of constantly grumbling about this translation. There are sections of it that she doesn't like, and she'll retranslate in her Dharma talks on the subject. And at the same time, they come out with some really real treasures of language. They have, to my mind, a way of condensing the ideas into some really kind of pithy kind of treasures of language. So, any questions about that? So, what I'll do then, mostly I want to just look at the text, but I want to just give these introductory remarks. And what I'll do is read to you the three different translations of the first line of this text, and you can just get a feel for what the difference is. And then we'll talk about some meaning that seems to be able to be pulled out. So the first translation is this one that Reverend Master Jiu herself did, and she worked on her translations while she was in Japan. And She wasn't an expert in Japanese, although she did a pretty good quick study of it and can speak Japanese, and did it in Japan at Sojiji much of the time, and so was working with Japanese, Sojiji, Japanese monk. So Genjo Koan, and it's translated in her translation as the problem of everyday life. And we can understand problem as the kind of question or the koan of everyday life. Koan, Genjo Koan. And that means the spiritual question, the spiritual kind of issues that arise in everyday life. So she starts with delusion, enlightenment, training, life, death, Buddhas and all living things are in existence when there is Buddhism. None of the above exists when all is within the truth. Since the way of the Buddha transcends unity and duality, all of the above exist. Whilst we adore flowers, they wither. Weeds grow strong, whilst we long for their destruction. So, that's interesting. So in this translation, the Nishiyama Stevens translation, they've translated Genjo Koan as the actualization of enlightenment. And so part of the issue, so there's an interesting other facet of that term, the problem of everyday life. Because in a sense, the question of everyday life is, how can we bring enlightenment to bear in our everyday life? How can we actualize enlightenment in the ordinary life that we have? So that's how they decided to translate it. When all things are the Buddha Dharma, there is enlightenment, illusion, practice, life, death, Buddhas, and sentient beings. When all things are seen not to have any substance, there is no illusion or enlightenment, no Buddhas or sentient beings, no birth or destruction. Originally, the Buddhist way transcends itself, and any idea of abundance or lack. Still, there is birth and destruction, illusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet, people hate to see flowers fall and do not make life weeds to grow. And then, Reverend Hubert's translation. So now he's translated the title on the spiritual question as it manifests before your very eyes. And that kind of is his, that's kind of expressive of his hallmark of training, in that he's trying to, you know, you probably know that in the Chinese and Japanese, those language which rely on ideograms, there are multiple facets communicated by ideograms, just as there can be multiple facets indicated by English words. And so he's trying to be able to express that kind of kaleidoscopic view of the use of characters. So his language is, the language in his translations tend to be a little wordier than in other translations. So here's his translation of that first opening line. In that period of time, when Buddhas give voice to the teachings on existence in all its variety, there is talk of delusion and enlightenment, of practice and training, of birth and death, of Buddhas, of ordinary beings. In that period of time when it is no longer relevant to speak of an I, along with its whole universe, there is no delusion or enlightenment, no Buddhas or ordinary beings, no being born, no extinction. Because the path to Buddhahood naturally springs forth from a feeling that there is too much of one thing or not enough of another. There is birth and extinction. There is delusion and enlightenment. There are ordinary beings and Buddhas. Yet, even though this is the way things are, still, we feel regret at the blossoms falling and we loathe seeing the weeds envelop everything. You might kind of think to yourself, were they reading the same text? But, yeah, I think they are. And we'll try to see what the underlying ideas are. Are we going too long?
As long as you need to go.
Okay. Shouldn't be much longer. Okay. So there are three basic ideas in here. And you might think, well, they're pretty abstruse, and how will they actually, you know, kind of apply to me? But I think they do. And I've seen it, I've been thinking about it lately and seen that they actually, kind of have application in our actual life. So delusion, enlightenment, training, life, death, Buddhas, and all living things are in existence when there is Buddhism. Now this is an interesting idea because it's talking about discrimination here. It's talking about identifying things and classifying them and saying, this is this, this is that, this is this, this is that. I'm this way, you're that way. It's talking about the discriminatory mind. And it's connecting that with Buddhist practice. Buddhism itself lives in the world of discrimination. Okay? You know, it's describing how to proceed through daily life. It's describing how to go about training in life. And it's also, by doing that, saying, don't do this other stuff over here. Do this stuff here. You know, it's basically this, not that, which is discrimination. So delusion, enlightenment, training, life, death, Buddhas, and all living things are in existence when there is Buddhism. When we're looking at things from the perspective of Buddhism, there is all this kind of description, the practice of Buddhism. None of the above exists when all is within the truth. When we actually sit down to meditate, when we actually encounter Buddha nature, when we actually let go of discrimination, even Buddhism ceases to be there. We don't have to hold on to discrimination. We can let go of that and see that there is this undivided truth. There is a life beyond duality. And we get a sense from that in meditation. Then, a third thing, since the way of the Buddha transcends unity and duality, all of the above exist. We need to, in other words, go beyond our experience of unity and actually practice the Dharma from the perspective of that unity. We need to transcend unity and duality and still engage in our own practice and still see that others are engaging in their practice. We can transcend both unity and duality. And that transcendence isn't, there is a danger in Zen when you awaken to the truth, have a deep awakening of the truth. You can kind of think, wow, you know, everything is perfect. I can kind of do what I want because it doesn't matter. And there is a certain truth to that, and still karma consequence exists. Still, all those things, delusion, enlightenment, training, life and death, all exist. And so the transcendence of unity and duality, the transcendence of the dualism of Buddhism, the unity of experience, is to continue to practice and give expression to the Dharma by continuing to practice. And that also enables us to accept our humanity. That enables us to continue to practice with a deeper understanding of practice, a deeper knowledge of how practice works, and still be a human being with foibles and faults. And to find a way to deal with those foibles and faults from a deeper place in daily life. So right here, right off the bat, he's kind of given us the essence of what Genjo Koan is and the ideas that he's going to be talking about. And this line, whilst we adore flowers, they wither, weeds grow strong while we long for their destruction, kind of sums up what our human life is. There's part of us that longs for something better. And then so, when you read from our other translations, When all things are the Buddha Dharma, there is enlightenment, illusion, practice, life, death, Buddhism, sentient beings. When all things are not seen, are seen not to have any substance, that is to say, when we see things from the point of view of this deep unity, there is no illusion or enlightenment, no Buddhism, sentient beings, no birth or destruction. Originally, the Buddhist way transcends itself and any idea of abundance or lack. Still, there is birth and destruction, illusion and enlightenment, sentient beings and Buddhas. In other words, what I'm talking about. We transcend unity and duality, and we find ourselves in just undivided practice. Yet, people hate to see flowers fall and do not like them. And then Erwin Huber's, which is, he's got more stuff going on in here. I'll have to think about this one more. In that period of time when Buddhas give voice to the teachings on existence in all its variety, there is talk of delusion and enlightenment, of practice and training, of birth, of death, of Buddhas, of ordinary beings. In that period of time when it is no longer relevant to speak of an I, along with its whole universe, there is no delusion or enlightenment, no Buddhas or ordinary beings, no being born, no extinction. So there are two general states. Because the path to Buddhahood naturally springs forth from a feeling that there is too much of one thing or not enough of another. There is birth and extinction. There is delusion and enlightenment. There are ordinary beings and Buddhas. Yet, even though this is the way things are, still we feel regret that blossoms fall. And we love to see the weeds in bloom. So there we have a start on this chapter. I think you, Dick, you sent that email to people. So there's links to the text that we're looking at. You can take a look at it and read if you want or not, if you don't want. Any questions or thoughts?
The part that says that sort of the desire to follow the Buddhist path arises from the discriminatory mind of there's too much of this, not enough of that. Do you think that that could be because the mind suspects delusion?
That's one way to describe it. Our deepest self, Buddha nature, is in a sense suspicious. It's like saying, there must be something more to it than this. It suspects that there's something not quite in harmony with what's true going on in our minds and the way we perceive.
That same line, to me it seemed like it was saying the first noble truth. Because of this, we find or search for something better. In other words, because of our discrimination, that kind of shows us that they're suffering.
Yeah.
And so we need to get on with practicing. That's at least the way it hit me.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And part of one of the things that we identify when we're talking about suffering is that some people don't recognize that they're suffering. Their discriminatory mind hasn't kind of said, oh, this, and actually, I shouldn't say some people. I look at my own mind and I see myself doing things which I like, which I know lead to suffering. And yet, at some level, I haven't really recognized that that leads to suffering. So, our discriminatory mind is functioning in there and saying, okay, in general, there's some suffering here. How do I deal with that? And I'll practice. And then as we go along, we're kind of subtly converting that, our experience to recognize, when we're doing something which creates suffering. And that really is what we call discriminating wisdom.
The very end of the second two translations seems logical that we don't like to see the flowers wilt and the weeds take a it's just, we, you know, we don't think that's good.
Right.
But the end of the first translation didn't seem to say that. There was something about, we grow stronger and we long for destruction. And I don't see how those two.
Yeah. I think I'll, reread that and we'll see. Whilst we adore flowers, they wither. Weeds grow strong whilst we long for their destruction.
Oh, we long for the weeds' destruction. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Not our own.
And it's a, in a way, a poetic way of describing the state that David and Marianne are talking about, where we find ourselves in a situation where we know what we like, and we know what we don't like, and we want to have things that way.
We want one and not the other.
Yeah. And part of that is good, because that's, in a sense, what starts us off in practice. And that's where the realm of Buddhism exists. And so we're taking that realm and we're using that practice to find this deeper realm where we actually transcend that process, where we go beyond the process of discrimination.
It seems like in Reverend Matthew G's translation, maybe that kind of emphasizes what seems to me to be one of the points she really emphasizes in that book about the universe not really being answerable to your personal will, so that even if I want, you know, all flowers or what have you, things are just going to kind of do their thing regardless, maybe.
It's a good point, because that, in a way, is why. I mean, in a sense, we could just spend our life in discrimination and trying to combat the, you know, kind of support the flowers and combat the weeds and find ourselves in a happier place. But that really points to the issue. That actually doesn't get us anywhere, because it's a never-ending process that doesn't lead to satisfaction. And so by looking at this possibility of transcending the situation, we've come to a way of finding satisfaction within those conditions. And please jump
in. I'm fading. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So anything?
I mean, I found your description before we got to the scripture of your relationship to reading Dogen similar to my relationship with other people. You know, that you know, trying to figure it out sometimes, and other times just think there's no hope.
Yeah.
And then how would you recommend to apply your approach, your final approach to Dogen, or part one of your approaches to Dogen, of the letting wash over you to our relationships with other people?
Well, I think that you've already, that by kind of saying there's no hope, and by being there, you let it wash over you. But I think the important thing about other people is to not give up on them, which is, in a sense, one of the important things about Dogen, too. Is to not give up on ever understanding it. The problematic thing with people, and particularly people who have long-term relationships on this bit, is the point where we say, there's no hope. And there may not be any hope in the particular specific instance, but if we can continue to kind of come back to it and keep trying within that point, within the point of view of being still, then eventually something changes and we think, oh, that's what they were trying to communicate to me. But if we, and again, this is particularly important with other people and people who have long-term relationships with, if you give up on them, if you kind of, you know, in the real sense, kind of close the door to them, then you cut off the possibility of understanding them. Sometimes you might just have to kind of leave the house in order to kind of diffuse whatever's going on. And that's not what I mean by giving up, but if you can kind of continue to come back to it. And to just continue to be still and be willing to, on a kind of intuitive level, take whatever next step appears. I think of having a relationship with other people as being a kind of caution, but you don't really know where it's going to end up. And part of the conversation is you have to really listen to what someone else is saying and really try to understand where they're kind of coming from. Does that make some sense?
I don't know if this will help, but sometimes it helps me to think of my communication with someone else as meow, 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 meow. And then they say meow, meow, meow.
And that?
It's sort of letting the conversation wash over me.
Right, kind of in another language that you don't think.
Yeah.
Like the adults in Charlie
Brown.
Yeah.
And how, I don't know, when my cat talks to me, I still find it meaningful.
Yeah.
She's trying.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm trying.
If you can kind of see that you really are trying, then that in this. Oh, another thing about talking to people is that if you think of another person as the Buddha and try to actually talk to them as if they were the Buddha, then that somehow changes your mind. I mean, they may be doing something completely absurd, but if you still think, there's a Buddha in there and I'm going to talk to them, but I had this experience, yeah, anyway, then that can also help because it's this, even if you're kind of talking in different language, there's still this attempt to find that common. And to just hold out that faith.
Thank you.